This is Mae Warren. Today is the 24th of May, 1996. I'm in Charlottesville, Virginia with Fran Lawrence. And I've been sent here by your old friend Bob Huntley, which I'm sure you find very amusing.
Right.
What exactly was your position in May of 1970?
I had been elected student body president for the next year. And I'm going to guess that election must have been mid-April. I had recently been elected.
So you were a junior at this point?
Right.
Okay.
Although it was my third junior year.
Oh, now let's step back. Let's get some background here. How did that happen?
So I started Washington Lee, you know, I was there 10 years. I started
Washington
Lee.
No, I don't know that.
Yeah, we should know.
Well, this
that.
Is great.
Maybe I should be just sort of one of the long-termers. I started Washington Lee in late August, September, actually late August, because I played freshman football, of 1965. And I very quickly adopted Lexington. My first summer I stayed in Lexington and worked at a restaurant in town.
Which one?
It was then Neo's House of Beef. Neo's House of Beef. It was tied in with the Neofotis family. They owned the College Inn restaurant, which is now a bakery or something. Mm-hmm. For many years it was kind of one of the student main college related places, and they also opened a House of Beef at the Holiday Inn, because that was the property belonged to Steve Neofotis, and it had been called Stevesville, and it was a motel there. They sold to they opened a restaurant there, and then they sold to the Holiday Inn.
Do they have any relation to Steve's Diner?
It was, in fact, Steve Neofotis' father who had Steve's Diner, and he bought it from New England or New York or somewhere in the 30s, I'm told.
Ah.
Steve Neofotis had Steve's Diner and the motel where the Holiday Inn is now, called mm-hmm. Stevesville Motel. And his son, who was Pete Neofotis, married a woman of Italian background, who was Marie Antoinette D'Alessio. And they had, the two of them, opened the College Inn. So there was a time when there was the Southern Inn owned by the, also a Greek family, and I can't think of their name, and Maharis. The Maharis's owned the Southern Inn, and down the street the College Inn was owned by the Neofotis.
Do you know how to spell that name?
Neofotis, yeah, N-E-O-F-O-T-I-S. And the third generation, George Neofotis, is still in and out of Lexington. Lives part of the year in Florida and part of the year in Lexington.
Oh, yeah? Because so, I'd love to find a picture of Steve's Diner.
Yeah, and he probably has one.
Wow.
And that certainly is something that should be there, because it was open 24 hours in its heyday. And it was closed by the time I got there, so it was really a 50s place.
A lot of people have been talking about it.
Yeah.
So, okay. So that's a great clue. Thank you.
All right, so anyway, so I stayed the summer and worked at Neo's House of Beef, which was the upscale beef, you know, steakhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And then my sophomore year, I opened a coffee house and a couple other things, you know, that year. And
where was that?
The coffee house was initially in the basement of the Mayflower Hotel, which is now the nursing home or mm-hmm. adult home. And then it was moved. Then it moved into the location where Freddie Goodhart has a secondhand store. And it was called the Ship's Hold. And it was, I guess, the first coffee house in Lexington. And it was open for kind of off and on from about August through February of 1966-67. And then that next summer I stayed in Lexington. That next summer I left Lexington and went to work in New York. And then I came back and was injured playing football in what was my normal junior year. And I left in the fall and hitchhiked around the country and went ahead and took the second semester off. And then I came back the next year and finished the first semester of my junior year, got sick the second semester, so took that off. So I had come back then in January of 1970 to do the second semester of my junior year. And I guess I had stayed in Lexington. And I stayed in Lexington that summer, I guess, that's right. So that's how I got. So back on campus in January of 70, elected in April of 70.
Because you were the most senior person.
Well, I was the most senior, and actually, the interesting thing, I guess, is that I think that that the student body had become more. I was more likely to have been elected in the spring of 70 than I would have been in the spring of 68.
Why?
Because the student body had become marginally more liberal. And I had been probably a perfectly normal freshman, played football, and my sophomore year opening the coffee house and not being active in the fraternity. And at the time there was kind of a, it was before the word hippie had been coined, but there was kind of a new left, or a kind of intellectual crowd. That crowd ate at the Paramount, which was owned by, actually it may have been owned by Ted Maharis, who was the son of the Maharis from Southern Inn. So there was kind of a group of English teachers and philosophy teachers and other people who identified themselves as out of the mainstream or liberal or whatever. They tended to be involved in theater and somewhat scornful of the attorney system. And so, and I kind of, by virtue of having this coffee house, I became sort of, and not being active in the fraternity. So I was viewed as a liberal, I guess, although I still played some football and stuff. So there was, it was never perfect. But the student body was much more conservative than I was, even though I was probably at best a moderate liberal.
So and that was an interesting transition period.
Yes,
at Washington,
yes,
and Lee.
Yes.
And we talk about that change in, yes, the fraternity life, the change in dress, mm-hmm, all of that.
Yeah. Can we or did you?
No, would,
oh,
you,
yeah,
please?
Sure. So, you know, Mario Salvo and the free speech movement in Berkeley, I think, was in 1964, and it certainly was no effect that I saw at all in 65-66. But I was on the student body executive committee. I was elected in the spring of my freshman year. And you know the executive committee is the 12-member body that runs the student body?
Tell me about it.
Well, the student body has been for many years run by an executive committee of 12 students. I think 10 undergraduates, two from each undergraduate class, that's 8. One from the law school is 9, and the 3 officers, president, vice president, and secretary, treasurer, student body, is 12. And it has been both the judicial and the legislative body of the student body, so the same 12 people, the honor committee. And I believe that is still true.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran in the spring of my freshman year and was elected to the executive committee, one of the 2 sophomores. So during this year that we were in transition, and I was in transition personally too, sort of becoming, you know, more liberalized or radicalized or whatever you want to call it. I was on the student government at the same time. And the student government was more conservative than I was. But that student government actually did 2 things. One is it actually elected to discontinue fancy dress. And that was because it had become unpopular. I think that it was dry, I believe, on campus. It was kind of it had become kind of viewed, I think, like a high school dance at the high school gym, really. You get dressed up and go to this dance and then go somewhere else and have your parties. And it was a time when dressing up formally just was in low esteem. So we actually killed it.
So did you attend a fancy dress as a freshman?
I think there was a fancy dress when I was a freshman, and you have to check on it. I cannot certain of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember whether we killed it. The honor committee actually, or the executive committee actually convened in the spring of 66.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's something we did in the spring of 66, well, that still would have been for 66, 67. So I don't know. So the answer is I think there was a fancy dress my freshman year, and I remember fancy dress weekend because it snowed like mad. But I don't remember going to fancy dress. So it may be that we used it as a party weekend and didn't go to fancy dress, but there were fraternity parties. And that's probably what did happen. So, in any event, it was clear that the fancy dress ball itself really had virtually no support. So that was killed. We also, but this was pretty much a conservative relatively conservative executive committee, and the executive committee, you know, 12 students, that's a process which is not going to pick, you know, the lunatic fringe. So this was fundamentally a conservative executive committee on the fancy dress. We weren't trying to be radical. We also voted to end traditional dress, but this was also not really a radical move. It was a move in response to an increased unwillingness to do it. And when I visited the Washington Lee campus in the spring of 1965 on a weekend tour, I was actually a Baker scholar. And Baker and Baker and Lee scholars were full scholarships, which I parenthetically lost because I ran this coffee house and let my grades go to hell. So it was a total disaster economically. I mean, I lost money in the coffee house and I lost my scholarship, but anyway. That weekend, the campus was all plastered with signs that said, I can't remember the guy's name, it's back there, it was Free John Smith. Posters all over the campus because John Smith had been assimilated almost out of school. The assimilation committee would ticket you if you didn't wear a coat and tie. Now, there probably had been a time before the mid-60s when people wore coats and ties completely voluntarily. There may not have been a time either. In other words, I'm not sure it was ever that golden era. But by 1964, the student body, at least one guy said, I ain't wearing a coat and tie, and I have a right not to. So he got ticketed, and they finally ended up suspending him from school. And that was too much, even for, that was one of the first things that kind of a little bit radicalized the student. Even normal people thought, wait a minute, you know, this is getting a little out of control here. We're going to actually throw a guy out of school for not wearing a coat and tie. And so faced with that by the spring of, yeah, by the spring of when I was elected, so either after I was elected in April or in the next fall, still with me, fall of 66, 67, our executive committee voted to make traditional dress voluntary. And but that didn't mean that overnight the people stopped wearing coats and ties, but that was certainly a chink in the beginning of the end of traditional dress.
How long did it take?
Well, it took until May of 70, in my memory, but I'm not certain, and that's because what happened, one of the things that happened May of 70 was the dress changed so dramatically, that one of the most dramatic changes was the way people dressed, and that all occurred in about a week and a half. So, I mean, that was an interesting byproduct of that. By 66, 67, there was some awareness. There was some concern about the conservatism of Washington Lee. There was some thought that there was some kind of more probing, non-conformism, I guess. There was the other people thought we need to be more diverse, or you need to have freedom to express yourself in different ways. A person that no one would tell you to talk to, probably from the administration, just because he still kind of pisses them off, I think, is Henry Sloss, S-L-O-S-S. And he came back last spring, and he was actually not renewed as a follow-up to May of 70, in part because he really became committed to some of the feelings and beliefs of the new generation, or of the new liberalism, or whatever, and I'm still grasping for characterization of that. But he was an English professor, and he became, I think Washington Lee would say, he spent less and less time teaching English and more time kind of trying to corrupt young minds. Okay, and he's a nice guy and very articulate. And I can't remember, I think he was there as early as 66, 67, but I'm not certain. And he would, if you want to get some more, he was certainly part of the new left. And the people that ate at the College Inn, I mean, ate at the Paramount Inn, which is now Harps.
Harps, uh-huh.
And other persons who ate there, Mario Pelcharo, Harry Pemberton, Little Bob Huntley, occasionally. Dabney Stewart, some. Herman Taylor. Henry Sloss, of course. And then students that are of note, a couple of interesting students who were a little ahead of me and every bit, probably fundamentally more conservative, than both football players, William Sledge from Alabama and Brian Kendrick, who is a minister now, connected to Bowman Gray School of Medicine in North Carolina. And Brian Kendrick was the captain of the football team in 19, I think, 66, 67, or 67, 68, and became very radicalized at Washington Lee, surprisingly, from kind of a, and he was from somewhere in South Carolina, and William Sledge was from Alabama, Bobby Brickhouse, who was a journalist here in Charlottesville, was also part of that thing, and they had a cabin called Innisfree, where they lived, that was a center of kind of new party where people went who decided not to no longer belong to fraternities. These were not NUFUs. You know what NUFUs are? Non-fraternity. Well, anyway, Washington was so overwhelmingly fraternity, like 85 or 88% in the mid-60s. There was a small group that never belonged to fraternities, and they were NUFUs for non-fraternity. And some did that out of philosophy, and some probably did it because they didn't get attorneys they wanted to or didn't get any attorneys at all. By 66, 67, and moving into the later 70s, more and more people who had been in fraternities or never been in fraternities did things away from the fraternities. Now, I think the membership may not change much, but it was a more significant group. So that was beginning to happen. The dress code was becoming more relaxed. There was some noise about I guess there was. I was trying to think whether it was. I don't remember any kind of movement to open up the dorms. The dorms still, you couldn't have women in the dorms, although they may have called them girls then. They certainly called them girls. And
my guess is that they were called.
Yeah, one of my daughter's is a senior in high school and actually plays a lot of sports. And we were at Heritage High School. One of the funny girl woman things is at Heritage High School. Looking at the banners, it's in Lynchburg. They're boys. It's like it's lots of boys. Boys champion, women's champion, boys champion, girls champion. It's like it's very interesting. And never men's. Women more than girls, but often girls. And of course, the high school. I guess high school is actually boys and girls. I think we should probably agree on that. But anyway, etc. So we're into 66, 67, 60.
Let me just ask you on the conventional dress. I'm curious,
traditional dress, let's call it.
Actually, the older people call it conventional dress.
Oh, okay.
A generation before you calls it conventional dress.
Of course they would, because it was conventional, and for us it was traditional. Okay.
Now, I'm glad you're making that distinction, because I've never heard anybody say that, and that makes sense to me,
because
I'm of your generation.
Yeah.
Was there anything going on in the classes? Say, would seniors be holding on to their ties for dear life and freshmen coming in being more casual, or did it sort of wave its way through the whole student body?
I don't have a strong... My sense is it probably... I don't know the answer to that. I think... But I guess this would had to be that the core of the people who ate the Paramount, and that's the only center that I can remember, and you may hear about that if you talk to other people that were there then, that they were upperclassmen who had started out a more traditional route. But I guess that would have to be, they would have been leaders, and they were leaders, Brian Kendrick, and a fellow named Roger Brown was another guy that played music who was in that group. Another person who was a year or two ahead of me, Don Baker, who had is also tied into this era. And in 66, 67, he and his roommate, whose name I can't remember, had an art gallery on Jefferson Street down in the bottom there, which is, became later a Chamber of Commerce or a visitor center, right at the bottom of the Washington Street.
Yeah, East Washington.
East Washington, bottom hill there, called An Agamemnon Dead. and that was, so we had, actually that year we had the coffee house that part of the time that, that I had up on, by then it was, by the school year, by after November, I guess it was there on Jefferson Street, where Freddie Goodhart is, and then and Agamemnon Dead was his art gallery, and they'd have parties. And the parties there, and Innisfree, which was a cabin out at this farm out Thornhill Road, were places where the intelligentsia or the new left or whatever the hell, it was not hippie, so it would have been beatniks, I guess, if people characterized us in derogatory, kind of had, and there was a group of people that sort of were whatever. So that was, but that was not a force. Then we go into 67, 68. And all I remember about that, Lee McLaughlin was still a football coach. And I played football in the fall of 67, 68. And got hurt. And I came to see Lee McLaughlin in like the 1st of December because I was in the hospital in Northern Virginia for a couple of weeks getting an operation on my chest. And I said, went to see Lee, and I said, Coach, I'm going to go ahead and just take off the rest of this semester because I can't catch up, and I'm going to take off next semester and go around and just go ahead and travel a little bit, and I'll come back next fall. And he said, well, well, you have a good time now, but don't you come on psychedelic. Don't you come on psychedelic. So psychedelic had, the word psychedelic had hit by the fall of 67, I guess. And I, and then I left didn't come back until April. But I remember that year my roommate and I had strange stuff in our apartment. You know, sort of wall, purple wall hangings and stuffed animals, and Day-Glow paint was on the campus by then, and there was peace signs were around a little bit. So there was, although my roommate actually stayed in the fraternity, and I stayed, I think, as a social member. But there was more presence of weirdness, different, and more apartments tended to be sort of funky and hippie-like. And marijuana was there by, the fall of, it may have been there in 65, 66, but I was not aware of it. But I remember, and I was not aware of it, and there was certainly some there by 66, 67. And after 67, I went to Long Island and worked, and that was where I saw people being introduced to it, I'll put it that way. Okay, and I'll talk about what I saw around me. And then, so by the fall of 67, 68, marijuana was back. And the funny thing about that was that, this is probably true, the first semester of 67, 68, people smoked marijuana in the fraternity houses. Okay? Just, you know, after dinner, have a cup of coffee and smoke a marijuana joint. By the, I'm going to guess, by the spring semester of 68, it was a $50 fine if you smoked in the fraternity house. And by the first semester of 69, my guess is that you got thrown out of the fraternity. What happened was, nobody even knew what it was, kind of. And by the fall, it was big, an awareness of it being around was there, where the fraternities were beginning to get concerned about that they would get in trouble if they let people smoke there. And by the next year, it had become kind of a capital offense. And in fact, people didn't smoke in the fraternity house anymore.
Right. Something that happened in there is the change of administrations. did the transition from Cole to Huntley have anything to do with?
I don't remember that being the case. I remember that Cole, I remember thinking that Cole assisted in the intellectualizing of the campus, because at least by reputation he had he stood for an aggressive improvement of the faculty, and I think that's what he's been by myth anyway. He came in and was destined to fail because Francis Penland Gaines had been so charming and attractive and was so well loved. So he if he didn't know it, poor baby, he wasn't going to be there very long. But then he came in and his emphasis was on faculty, and he may have actually hired Henry Sloss, for instance, or been involved in that, or he felt like our faculty had gotten very complacent. So at least I thought he was bringing people in, and that may have helped move the campus into the 20th century. You know, radicalization is probably too strong a word. It's like modernization is probably the more appropriate word. So anyway, so Bob, I don't remember Bob when Bob first came in. I mean, Bob ascended so quickly. You know, 1 year at the law school. You know, teach, dean, president of the university. And well thought of, popular from the very beginning. I mean, he was young, attractive, and with Evelyn and young kids, and so I mean, he was all my sense is he's always popular. But then I've always liked him, so I'm not sure that I would have any other sense about it. When we talk about the marijuana, the rules and stuff like that. Now, I think that was just natural evolution, really. It was something nobody knew about. It didn't make any difference, and then it became more prevalent, and they had to outlaw it, and it went underground. And it was so there was, but that so that probably contributed. The marijuana was identified with the hippie movement, and probably by now the word hippie had been coined into 67, 68. But the 68 stuff that happened other places, nothing happened in Washington. There was some things that was up against the Ivy Wall. Weren't the strikes? I think there were strikes in the spring of 68, but we didn't
Paris.
Have anything. We didn't have anything.
No, it was 69 in Paris.
Okay. No, something happened in 68. I think I think they sat in at Columbia. I think the book Up Against the Ivy Wall actually came out of something that happened in 68.
Yeah,
so,
you're right.
So, for the life of me, I can't remember. Oh, I traveled, came back to Lexington in April of 68. I started off working in Miami Beach with short hair, ended up coming back with kind of reasonably long hair, although I certainly didn't look like a hippie, but I guess I looked different. And I grew a mustache that year, and I've kept it ever since then. And came back in the fall of 68. And I don't have any huge memories of that first semester of 68 into 69. I know that there continued to be more people dropping out of fraternities, that there was a group of people who lived in town in apartments over Woody Chevrolet, over top of where the White Front grocery store is. There were a number of guys, and I know names, Marty Mullins, Pete Eggers, Clint Palmer. These guys were all in the class of 70, and that class had more, a little more diversity, and more kind of liberal people and people with alternate lifestyles. There were a couple of bands on campus by then. Oh, one of the other interesting things was in the 67-68 school year, the fall of 67, which is when. The first new band came. It had been traditionally soul music, or that kind of music, both white and black bands, but soul music, mm-hmm. basically. And our fraternity brought down a band from Long Island called the Moof, M-O-O-F. And it was Long Hairs, and actually the lead guitarist, and the lead guy was actually a paraplegic. Who played a mean guitar, and they helped him onto this high stool, and he was wild, and they all had long hair down their shoulders, and they played they had a strobe light, and they played this and it was they played we had to bring him down for the whole weekend because we brought him down from Long Island. So Friday night at our fraternity there was a fair number of people there. By Saturday night, half the campus was there to see what this band was doing. So, and that was no little thing that was happening.
Which fraternity were you in?
Phi Kappa Psi, on Washington, across from the police station.
Oh, convenient place.
and actually, Phi Psi was tended to be a northern fraternity. And despite William Sledge and Brian Kendrick and Roger Brown, these people who were from the South, who were part of this sort of first New Left movement, I guess the northern kids were always a little more likely to be liberal, or at least to be less likely to be conservative, whatever I mean. So the Phi Psi house was pretty much mostly northern kids. I was from Alexandria. That we had one, a couple other Virginians, and one kid from Alabama, and otherwise New Jersey, New York. So we're now at, and then I was got sick in the spring of 69, and stayed out of school and didn't come back to school until January of 70. So I'm not quite sure what the campus was like in the fall of 69. I do know that my class left there pretty much unchanged. In other words, the class of 69 is very different than the class of 70, 71, 72, 73, because all these things didn't happen. And although there was certainly some movement, there was some liberalization and some radicalization and some increasingly diversity and whatever it is that to be radical. Radical is too strong a word, but in that direction. There was some of that in class 69, but for the most part, class 69 graduated without what, because they missed the spring of 70. So the spring of 70 was certainly a huge event, and it changed the classes for the next few years, and that class 69 had been affected by that.
Okay, now before we make that big transition, yeah. Another thing that happened in that time period, I believe, is the first couple of black students arrived on campus.
Yes.
Were you aware of that happening?
Yes.
And
yes.
What occurred then?
Not much. I mean, to me it wasn't much. And I had actually, I actually had a date with a black woman in at a party in, must have been 67, 68. 66, 67, I think. So there were black students at the women's college. She went to Randolph-Macon, and so there must have been black guys in my class. I think the black kids entered in the fall of 65, but I can't for the life of me recall. Who the ones in my class were. Walter, actually Phi Psi had a black.
Walter Blake?
Yeah, Walter Blake was a Phi Psi. Mm-hmm. But he must have been at least 2 years. He must not have come until the fall of 67, I don't think. And there were black kids before him. There were black kids before him, but I can't remember. And Johnny Morrison, is he a law student or was he, do you know? Or did he go with me?
I think law.
I think so too.
I think long.
And I remember we had, you know, some Orientals and some Hispanics. Jorge Estrada was in my class. He was in South America, and Glenn Azuma was a class behind me. He had some Asian American background, but it was pretty skinny, let me tell you. But I don't remember. I think that we, meaning the liberals, were pleased that there were some blacks there. And I don't remember there being any event about it. And my attending a party for black date, one person said something. One person said that they were glad that I had gone to the party with a black date. And one of the persons made some kind of funky remark, but otherwise it was a non-event. But this was in a group of, mm-hmm. you know, people who made it a point to, you know, be liberal. So I don't know what that tells you. So I don't remember that as having any cultural significance or any significant cultural significance, because it was a very small number of people. Mm-hmm. And you have to ask, you know, I don't know what it was like for them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Walter was probably the person I knew the best. And he's real charming and very comfortable in any setting. So I don't know that, you know, I don't know that he would his experiences wouldn't be as bad as some might be. So, so then we went into the, so then I don't know what happened first semester of 60, so then we're into the spring of 70, and the digression started with, I could not have been elected student body president in the spring of 68, for all the reasons I've just told you. And I remember actually thinking that, I remember thinking that Washington Lee didn't really like me. That's maybe a little too strong a word, but that they would have been more pleased. Some of the administration would have been just as pleased as that I wasn't there. And I think probably everybody who was involved in the Paramount Inn, Ann Agamemnon dead, Innisfree, another group was the first performance in the Lime Kiln was in the summer of 66.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know
and
that.
And it was, it had its anniversary. Maybe it was 67 because it'd be 30 this year, and it's done 25, and I'm not quite sure when it did it, 25. So it may have been the next summer. But Don Baker was involved in Midsummer Night's Dream. And actually, and I played because the wonderful old man that was supposed to play Agamemnon, was supposed to play Ancient Aegeus,
mm-hmm.
got sick at the last minute, so I actually played Ancient Aegeus, so I performed in that. And that was in the summer. And staying in the summer was something that had never happened to Washington Lee. I mean, the first summer I stayed there, there was like five students in town. And as the campus became more radicalized, more people stayed there. It became more of a community. And also another thing that happened in about 67 or 68 was some people from the tomato farmers or the some people from California picked Lexington as a place to come to. And one was Jim and Nancy Galloway, and he is actually a professor at the University of Virginia, and that had an effect. So they kind of bought a farm or rented a farm and opened up a health food store on Main Street where the nice inn is, I think, which then became Maida McGuire's restaurant and now is the very elegant Wilson Walker House. And that was originally a California health food restraint in about 68, 69.
Would that last 30 seconds?
Well, that lasted for a while, and then it evolved into Maida McGuire took it over, and it was kind of a, still kind of a little bit of a...
I thought it had been Jabo's before that.
It had been Snooki's Town Inn first.
Snooki's
Town Inn back...
Where was Jabo's?
I don't know.
That was before your time?
Yes. Okay. When I was there, it was Snooki's Town Inn was the Wilson Walker House. At the hotel across the street was the Liquid Lunch.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Docs, D-O-C-S, Docs, mm-hmm. Liquid Lunch, they called it. And then across the street was a College Inn. Around the corner was a Paramount Inn, where Harb's is. Down the street, Nice, was a Southern Inn. And that's about it. So spring of 70, and of course, increasingly, don't underestimate the power of the Vietnam. I got... a physical notice in September of 66 to show up for a physical. I had to go to Northern Virginia for a physical. And then I actually got drafted in April of 69. By the time I had this virus of the heart lining, I was actually in bed, so I couldn't go. But that just gives you a sense about, I mean, there was something going on here also. The screws were getting turned. So if I got a physical in September or October of 66 and then actually drafted, show up tomorrow to be sworn in. I mean, it wasn't a physical or anything. I mean, I was in the Army April of 69. That was happening to other people, too. So that certainly did begin to fan the flames of the anti-war movement.
Now, how is that beginning to happen to people who, I presume, would have student deferments?
Well, but I think the deferments began to fall away. The deferments were certainly there. I got deferred as a student when I went for my physical in September, October of 66. Okay, but by 69, the student deferments were I think, gone, And then the lottery system came in. Mm-hmm. But by then, I was out of it because of health problems, so I never paid much attention to that. But I think the lottery must have come in after the spring of 69, because I don't remember having any awareness of the lottery. I just got drafted. Mm-hmm. So then after that, you didn't have deferments, but you had a number, and you were more or less likely, depending on what your number was. All right. So then I came back in January, we were in a big house across from Carl Alto with five or six different people, and the mixture of people, probably two of the five were still active in their fraternities and three weren't. So there was more mixture of fraternity and non-fraternity, and even the kids, although some fraternities were still pretty conservative. I don't remember much until it all occurred in May, although I know that Jeff Gingold, who was the most articulate leader of the anti-war movement on campus, had a presence throughout the winter and spring of 70, and there were other things going on, and there certainly was an anti-war group at Washington Lee. I was not a part of that. They were more liberal and more radical than I was. I'm sort of a Democrat. I have sort of liberal leanings, but moderate liberal. And there were more people. By now it had moved. Certainly there was a significant number of people who had longer hair now and who looked like hippies. And they were more of a presence on the campus, but I can't tell you percentage-wise. Still a minority. And still this sense that I had, that neither me nor they were particularly welcome. May have been just paranoia. But I mean, I think that, no, it's not paranoia. Washington Lee really was, and it still has to worry about that. It still needs to reach out, I think, to people that are more diverse. But anyway. So then, bang, we're to May, all right? And I'll be specific as I can remember. I had been elected student body president, and Jerry Rubin and William Kunstler were speaking here at University Hall.
Here in Charlottesville.
Here in Charlottesville. And Kent State, yes, I you have to check this. I can't remember whether it was serendipitous or whether Kent State occurred the day they spoke or the day before they spoke. But probably 30 or 40 students from Washington came over to University Hall to listen to him. And there was there had been picketing up and down the colonnades before the Kunstler speech. But it was really a very few people, and they were stood out like a sore thumb.
Picketing for what?
Picketing against the war. Mm-hmm. So there were as early as mid-April, there was a group of avid anti-war people, I would say very, very few in number, under 20.
And what were they hoping to achieve picketing Washington and Lee?
I don't know whether the concept of the student strike had occurred or not before Kent State. I think it had, maybe. So they were asking, they wanted to go out on strike in protest against the war. So I remember walking in front of what was then the business school, which was the building on the left, is the library, the old library, and then the first building, the far left building in the colonnades, was the business school.
Newcomb?
There. Yeah, Newcomb. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing the guys in front of Newcomb Hall. Maybe they picked Newcomb Hall because that was the most conservative group of students who were in the business school. But they were a very small number of people, and it was like three or four of them picketing in shifts. So anyway, so then the whether Kent State occurred or whether Kunstler and Rubin occurred, is Kunstler was unbelievably effective. The only thing that kept Virginia from being burned to the ground that night, I think, was that Rubin followed Kunstler, and Kunstler had the crowd in a lather. Rubin just aimlessly strolled around and talked and cussed for 35 minutes, and he couldn't have been hired to have done a better job of sort of dissipating all this angst, right? So after the thing was over, I was on the floor and on off to the side of one podium was maybe, I'm going to say, between 15 and 30 Washington Lee students. And somebody was in the middle of them saying something like, "And we're going to join in solidarity with our brothers and sisters at the University of Virginia and go out and march on the campus," meaning in Charlottesville. And I said, and somebody came to me and said, you know, this is the first thing I've seen sort of crisis. Somebody came to me and said, you know, you got to do something about this. You know, we're all going to go do some stupid stuff here if somebody doesn't stop us. I mean, in essence, saying, help me help myself. So I said something, you know, I got over there and said, you know, this doesn't make any sense. You know, we go to Washington, we're going to go to school here. You know, if you have some problems, you want to sort of, you know, have a colloquy or whatever, the place to do it is in Lexington, not out here on the streets of Charlottesville tonight. So that's crazy. You know, go back to Lexington, and you guys can meet and do whatever you want to do. And that worked.
You need to turn the tape over.